This is Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on RN. Daniel Browning here with you. Bruce Pascoe is a great storyteller as well as a writer of history. At the heart of his 2014 book, Dark Emu, is a bold assertion which explodes a foundational myth of white Australia, that Aboriginal people were nomadic hunter-gatherers. In Dark Emu, which has been named Book of the Year at the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, as well as joint winner of the Indigenous Writing Prize, Bruce Pascoe contends that Aboriginal people occupied, farmed, and harvested the land for generations. They even built houses. He argues that the hunter-gatherer myth was a convenient lie that enabled dispossession, at least in the colonial mind. The judges, in awarding the prize to Dark Emu, say it's a vital book, injecting a profound authenticity into the national conversation, restoring Aboriginal achievement in governance and agriculture to the epicentre of Australian history. They also say that Bruce's voice is at once catalysing and unifying. Now, the evidence that underpins Dark Emu is drawn from records that even the most conservative historian wouldn't argue with. The journals and diaries of explorers, such as Sir Thomas Mitchell and Charles Sturt. The extraordinary success of Dark Emu may also see the book adapted for the screen. Here's Bruce Pascoe.
Well, it's into its sixth print run now, and it's been, you know, very successful. And it's because people have been telling each other about it. It's not that it's had billboard publicity anywhere. It's just that people have become interested in it. It struck a little bit of a chord, and I think Australia is starting to be interested in these things and interested in Aboriginal history and culture and the idea that we might have been misled about what Aboriginal people were actually doing with the land. You know, I say in the book that Aboriginal people were the first bakers in the world by a long 15,000 years. This is a fact that Australians find interesting. Not my generation. My generation find it threatening. But younger Australians think, you know, naturally, oh, that's fascinating. Because everyone's a foodie these days. Oh, the world's first bakers. Yeah, let's get into that. There's a lot to be gained by Australia examining these things and nothing to be lost.
In your research, well, in the book, what do you think is the most compelling piece of evidence that, you know, you can stake this claim of an established agriculture, of a system of land management? What's the most compelling piece of evidence you found?
Are you going to restrict me to one?
Oh, look.
Can I do three?
Do three.
Righto. Lieutenant Grey is in Western Australia. He's the first European walking across this country, and he comes across these fields that stretch to the horizon, and they've been so deeply cultivated for the production of yam that he can't walk across them. Sir Thomas Mitchell, on the other side of the country at around the same time, rides through 9 miles of stooked grain. Once again, he's the first European in the area. 9 miles of stooked grain. His fellows say, this looks like a European field of harvest. Then Sturt has his life saved by people in the very dead centre of Australia who have been growing grain there. They feed him roast duck and cake. Now, those three examples alone, and I read them within a couple of weeks of each other, told me that here was a history that had never really been seriously examined or had been cast aside by those who did read it. So I was so moved by the fact that it proved the sophistication of Aboriginal culture and the depth of the history. And so it was irresistible to me.
But it is a convenient lie when you establish. And, you know, we've all been brought up as Aboriginal people to believe in this hunter-gatherer myth.
I believed it.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I was told.
I consider myself to be an intelligent man. I believed it. That's why I was so shocked. Also, while I didn't grow up in an Aboriginal community, so it wasn't until I was 30 that I seriously started to examine the family story, a little bit of which I knew, but I had to learn my history from elders who I was asking questions about my family, and they said, well, you know, they virtually ignored me for 2 years, and they said, because you don't know your history. You know, we can't talk to you until you learn your history, because what we say about what happened to, you know, families is all tied up with history. So you've got to learn your history first. So I had to learn my history, and in the process of doing that, I came across this other evidence of what was happening that the explorers saw. Australia loves their explorers. They're these upright people, they're famous, they're heroic. God's own creatures, and Australians believe them. So when I started reading their journals, I thought, this is the way in. This is the way in to convince people that this actually did happen. Because there were a few people early on backing up to poo-hoo the idea and to say, well, they did actually say to me, Bruce, you can't use Aborigine in the same sentence as agriculture. They just said that to me, and, you know, that was just the worst thing they could have said, of course, because it was in incitement, and I raced out of that meeting and went to the second-hand bookshop and bought Sir Thomas Mitchell's Journeys into Tropical Australia, and there it is, 9 miles of stooked grain.
When you say stooked?
Yeah. It's like a hay rick. It just looked exactly the same as the Englishman.
As if it had been ploughed, perhaps.
As it had been harvested, and all the harvested stems picked up together and put in a pile. And so three or four of them to the acre, and Mitchell's men said it just looked like England. They felt at home because they were harvesting that grain to make bread.
It's one of the foundational myths, this idea that Aboriginal people ranged across a large area and only existed as hunter-gatherers. They made no permanent dwellings. I mean, there are so many complications in this lie. You know, those myths are being exploded almost, it seems like they're being exploded daily.
Yeah.
We have the discovery just very recently of the hafted axe in Western Australia, said to be 50,000 years old.
Mm.
What do you think about this? I mean, it does seem that all this dissembling and all these lies, the fabric and tissue of those lies seems to be being blown away at a rate lately.
The British had got very good at colonialism by the time they reached Australia. They'd perfected it. They'd honed its tools. And one of the deceptions that they had perfected was to decry the intelligence of the people whose land they took. In Canada and America, they lampooned the American Native people, the First Nation mob, even though those people had built fabulous houses, had fabulous art, had organised an agricultural economy, et cetera, but they were savages. They had to be proven to be savages. And the same happened in Australia, you know, and that's why every house that a European reached was burnt to the ground within weeks, if not that very day, because this is proof of occupation. And they had, according to their own example of what constituted a civilised person, they had to prove that we were barbarians. So they systematically got rid of the evidence. Now, it seems a harsh judgment. Of course, not every British person was like that. There was a fellow in the Western District of Victoria called Dawson who didn't do that, who raised money to put up gravestones for Aboriginal people, who recorded their language. His daughter spoke the language of the Gunditj Mara, but he still took the land. You know, he was a good man. He's a Christian, but he still took the land. So the very bad ones, if the good ones still take the land, the very bad ones do all the dirty work. And that happens in any war. In any war, you'll find people who will murder babies.
In fact, James Dawson, the let's call him a settler, a colonist from southwestern Victoria, was actually mentioned on the show in relation to the revival of Gunditj Mara and language programs being taught down there. Are you surprised that Dark Emu? I mean, I remember talking to you around before the book was finished, actually. You'd finished the book but it was certainly before publication, and I remember being excited by this idea that you were going to put, and it was revolutionary. It is revolutionary. Are you surprised that Dark Emu has managed to, you know, infiltrate and to, you know, what I think is remarkable about the book is it's so accessible, and it has to be, because I know that your market is very much other Aboriginal people, young fellas.
Yeah. Margaret Wiskin was the editor, and she was adamant that it had to be accessible like that, but that's how I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted young Aboriginal people to read it because they need the information. Mm-hmm. They'll be the ones who'll be fighting this in the courts in 50 years' time, hopefully in 3 years' time. But I wanted our people to read it, but I wanted young Australians to read it as well. And I told Mugabala, I said, this book is going to take off. You know, you might be inclined to try and pump your own tyres, but just because in searching out the information and going to libraries and talking to people involved in this kind of research, I realised that there was a bit of a groundswell building up. And I thought, you know, people are craving this idea. They're not resisting it anymore. They want the idea. So it was just a really good time to do it. But I got quite excited just talking to my own mob, you know, because so much more information was supplied as a result of Aboriginal people being involved in its production. It fortuitous that Mugambala were the publishers, but lots of good information came out of that relationship.
Did you approach any other publisher?
Yes.
And but the question, the reason I asked that question is because someone else missed this opportunity to publish this book.
Well, I'd had a novel called Bloke published, and the publisher had the option on Dark Emu and knocked it back, went to another publisher, and they were a bit concerned about the content, and so they knocked it back. And I was desperate because I knew that the book could make an impact. Mm. And I looked at the book as if it's an Aboriginal book. It's not my book, it's an Aboriginal book, because all the information was there. I was just flung at it. I was flung at that information. And I was sold on by Aboriginal people. Mm. Why, yeah, you've got to do that, you know. So it became a community book, and I knew it was going to work. So when I approached Mugambala, I was virtually begging, because they were the third or fourth people that had a look at it. And, you know, they were typical Mugambala. They're just bloody beautiful people. Of course I'm going to say that because they published my book, but you don't have to explain anything to Mugambala. They're Aboriginal people. Not all the people who work there are Aboriginal, but you don't have to explain Australian history. So it's comfortable, you know. Like, you write something that might seem a bit outrageous to other people, but they don't, oh, yeah, my father told me about that, or my auntie used to say that. It's just so comforting to work with people who believe what you say. It seems like heresy to a lot of Australian people, but to Aboriginal people, it's just what their mum said.
You did speak to me about the adaptation off the record. You know, we were talking about the adaptation perhaps for film of Dark Emu and about your options there. Film is a medium that you are becoming interested in.
When I was writing Dark Emu, I was thinking to myself, gee, I'd like to see, a black David Attenborough standing on a hill talking about that valley and what it produced and, you know, how Sturt's life was saved there and, you know, recreating the field where Mitchell rode through all that stooked grain. I thought, it lends itself to documentary. And so when the book, you know, started to have some success, I thought, gee, wouldn't it be great if we could do this in film? And we're hoping that we can make something of it. But, you know, film is such an uncertain area compared to publishing that, you know, you've got to find money for it. Whereas when you're publishing a book, you just got to find paper.
And sometimes you have to find the words.
Ah, yeah, well.
They come easily to you.
Yeah, I'll die with the words.
And the hope is that Dark Emu will become a film, that we will see it somehow recreated, I don't know if you're still thinking seriously David Attenborough style, but what's the hope for a film version of Dark Emu?
Yeah, we're looking at, you know, some of those incidents being in the film, but also some of the discussion that goes on around it, because I've been travelling ever since it came out, talking to farmers, permaculturalists, Aboriginal communities, all over the country, because these ideas are interesting to people. And it's a time when people are sensing there's a possibility of changing the Australian perception of their country. So, and Bill Gammage, we do zig and zag around the country. You know, Bill Gammage's book on the biggest estate on earth, talking about fire and Aboriginal use of fire and things like that, it shows that people aren't going to swallow the accepted history of Australia anymore. They want to know more. And I keep on saying to young Aboriginal people, don't waste a moment on the street. Get to school whenever you can. Do tertiary education. Get ready, because there's going to be stuff that we will want you to do in your lifetime, not mine, because it's going to be urgent. You know, there's going to be people who need to write history, people to make films, people to search out recipes for some of these foods, and people to be our politicians to redraw the whole workings of the Australian Constitution when that time comes, or a treaty, or whatever it is that we decide to do. But Aboriginal people have to decide to do it. If we wait for politicians to tell us, oh, look, we're going to rewrite the Constitution for you, that's not going to be good enough. We have to write that Constitution and say, are you going to accept this or not? Because we wait so long and wait so politely for government to give us something, and really they never give us something. There's always a tag at the end of it, which is a penalty. So it's time that we started thinking these things ourselves, designing the program and taking it to government and say, do you want to be involved in this, or will we fund it some other way? Because our local community on the south coast of New South Wales, there's a group, Gurungi Mungi, there, who have been growing some of these plants. We applied for government help and, you know, we got knocked back. So we did crowdfunding, and we employed a couple of people to work on the planting of those plants out of crowdfunding. Aboriginal people are genuinely surprised when non-Aboriginal people give them money to do something like that. And it was good for everyone, because the people who put their money in are happy and interested in the program. And Aboriginal people are going, what? That old lady gave us $1,000 to plant seeds? Yeah, brother, that's what she did. You know, it's fantastic for everybody. So much good is going to come out of it. These are going to be commercial plants. It's not just a feel-good enterprise. They're going to be commercial plants. I just hope that Australia remembers where these plants came from and who domesticated them and why. And if we can accept those things and not shovel them away like we did with the observation of the explorers, you know, to try and deny that Aboriginal people had agency on the landscape and were involved in an agricultural economy, then if we can accept that, then we can do it as a nation. You know, white people aren't going to go away, so Aboriginal people aren't going to dig out the old cooking oven again and go back as if 220 years hadn't happened. It's a different world now, a different nation. But Australia has to, non-Aboriginal Australia has to realise it's a different nation too. And it'll be exciting times. But that's why I'm saying to Aboriginal kids, get an education, as well as get your culture, but don't miss out on the education, because you're going to be busy. I hope you'll be very busy.
The storyteller and now screenwriter, Bruce Pascoe, whose work of history, Dark Emu, won Book of the Year at the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards on Monday. Bruce shared the Biennial Prize for Indigenous Writing with Ellen Van Nierven, who won for her novel Heat and Light. And you heard Ellen reading some of her poetry on the show a fortnight ago. Congratulations to the both of them. Bruce's new book, Mrs. Whitlam, is out soon. It and Dark Emu are both published by Magabala Books. And Bruce will join me on the show again in a few weeks with the filmmaker Dylan River to talk about their short film, Black Chook, which has its world premiere at the Sydney Film Festival.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.